Hello and welcome back to the first Pulse since we have been in lockdown. My name's Rebecca and I'm joined by Joe and Freya. It's a slightly different show today just because of the restrictions. We can't currently get into the studio, but we're hoping to do that in the following weeks. So today it's just going to be uploaded to Audio Boom. And so I would recommend, if you aren't already, to be following us on your own, at your own Pulse on Twitter, because that's where we'll be uploading the latest episodes. Hopefully all episodes. I mean, hopefully we won't, we'll also be able to go live, but it sort of depends. So the stories that we are going to be covering today are firstly about Boris Johnson's new update with the path to sort of getting out of lockdown restrictions. And then we're also going to be talking about the recent Q&A with the Vice Chancellor, which is to do with the fact that basically there are a lot of student concerns and their responses. We're then also going to be talking about the human rights groups, which are calling for a Winter Olympic boycott for the Beijing 2022 Olympics. So yeah, we're going to start off by just clarifying what the situation is with the new path out of lockdown. So Boris Johnson announced today that the roadmap steps are, well, I'll start off with step one, which is on the 8th of March, which will mean that schools, colleges are open for all students and practical higher education courses. The recreation or exercise with a household or one other person, no household mixing indoors, and with wraparound childcare, funerals, wakes and weddings. So funerals will be allowed 30 people, I think, and weddings 6, and wakes maybe. Then on the 29th of March, there'll be a rule of 6 or 2 households outdoors, no household mixing indoors. Outdoor sport and leisure facilities will be allowed, organised outdoor sport allowed for children and adults. Minimised travel, no holidays. Outdoor parent and child groups up to 15 parents. Then step two, at least 5 weeks after step one and no earlier than 12th of April, indoor leisure, including gyms, open for use individually or within household groups, rule of 6 or 2 households outdoors, no household mixing indoors, outdoor attractions such as zoos, theme parks and drive-in cinemas, libraries and community centres, personal care premises, all retail, outdoor hospitality, all children's activities, indoor parent and child groups, up to 15 parents, domestic overnight stays, household only, self-contained accommodation, household only, funerals 30, wakes, weddings, receptions 15, people, that is, people for both, and then minimise travel, no international holidays, event pilots begin. And then they've got step three, which is 5 weeks after step two, no earlier than the 17th of May, indoor entertainment and attractions, 30 person limit, outdoors, a rule of 6 or households indoors, subject to review, domestic overnight stays, organised indoor adult sport, most significant life events is 30 people, I think, remaining outdoor entertainment, including performances, remaining accommodation, some larger events except for pilots, capacity limit applies, indoor events 1,000 or 50%, outdoor other events 4,000 or 50%, outdoor seated events 10,000 or 25%, international travel subject to review. And then step four, which has some of the most exciting parts, is no legal limits on social contact. Sorry, this will occur at least 5 weeks after step three, no earlier than the 21st of June. So by step four, the government hopes to be able to introduce the following. So no legal limits on social contact, nightclubs, which is very exciting, obviously, for students, larger events, and no legal limit on all life events. So obviously, step four was like the most ambitious one, and that's in June. So yeah, I just, now that we've established that, I wanted to sort of put it out to the panel. What do you guys think of this path and these pathways?
I mean, it sounds great. It sounds brilliant. I can't help but sort of think quite pessimistically about whether it's going to actually end up playing out that way. But I guess with the vaccine, there is a possibility that it really could sort of play out in that fashion. But I don't know. What do you think, Joe?
Yeah, I think it's very optimistic, obviously, but that's good. I think that's kind of what we needed. We needed a sort of acknowledgement that this state that we're in now is going to end. There's some certainty, but it's still cautious. So I think it was really great. I was quite, it perked me up really that, you know, it's a kind of acknowledgement that, that this is going to end. What did still irritate me is that, you know, schools have been given a clear procedure for going back, if you like. But again, I think unis were mentioned, you know, very fleetingly once. I think it was stupid in January not to, you know, set up like a testing procedure like we had to come home at Christmas to go back to uni. And I think it's even more stupid now not to say anything more about it. That really does frustrate me. To my mind, that's just a very silly thing to do. But the rest of it is good news, other than the unis. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's good to give some sort of certainty, I suppose, on some level. I mean, it's all subject to change because we have been promised stuff previously and it's had to be adjusted accordingly. I think it's probably helpful for some businesses to have some idea of when they might open and so on, just so that they can, like, sort of plan their current situation. I don't really know how nightclubs are really coping. I suppose that's helpful for them because they've been sort of left out. Because they just can't open, really, in any sort of restrictions, apart from having that table situation that they were doing and stuff. So that's good. And it's just, I suppose, it sort of keeps people focused. The other risk, I suppose, is that maybe you encourage people a little bit too early to start, like, relaxing if they've got an idea. But I mean, it's basically as close, I think, as they could really announce it anyway, because obviously the step one is on the 8th of March. What did you guys think about the fact that they, like, didn't really mention unis again? Like, it's quite annoying, I think.
Yeah, I mean, part of me understands that you know, the student life is quite specific to students and doesn't really, you know, I guess regular quote-unquote adults don't really have the same sort of life that students have. But at the same time, you know, we are quite a significant percentage of the population, so I'm surprised that so little was said about it and that hasn't sort of been acknowledged a bit more. I'm a little bit reticent as well because the government has in the past sort of overpromised and then had to change because of, you know, emerging facts like Eat Out to Help Out, the Christmas plans, that sort of thing. Mm. So I think I'm naturally a bit reticent to get too excited about it, but I hope that with the vaccine, that the state of play is a bit different and that we really can sort of make some progress.
Yeah, I agree. I think it is, it's clearly, like, the vaccine, I think, is the thing that has made Boris able to announce something like, or the government able to announce something like this. I think without that, they wouldn't have been so confident in this. I think the fact that they haven't included universities, I don't think that's accidental. A lot of the time, apparently, it's, like, to do with negotiation with the universities, but I still think that's still a little bit difficult for people not necessarily to know what to do next.
Yeah, I think universities as institutions really should be a bit more frustrated that, you know, they've not got things to be planning for. You know, at the end of the day, we keep saying universities are a bit of a business kind of thing. Mm. They should be more frustrated. Or if it is, like you say, Rebecca, a fact that the universities haven't negotiated with the government or haven't talked to the government, that's even more reason for students like us to be frustrated and to kind of campaign, if you like, for unis to get a seat at the table. It just blows my mind that in January there was no scheme, proper official scheme, to send students back, and we know that students have gone back to their uni towns. That's pretty clear. But without that kind of safety net of testing in place, I know that our uni has an asymptomatic testing centre. I don't know the figures or whatever, but I'd be interested to see how many students everyone's been advised to get a test, how many have actually gone and got a test if it's not compulsory. You know, I think really there should have been something in place in January. I think they should have introduced something now. I just can't get my head around it, you know.
Yeah, I think also this idea that students weren't going to all sort of go back in their hordes when they found out sort of that we would be in lockdown is just a bit irresponsible, because, like, a lot of students, particularly, like, for instance, in my course, were getting really stressed about the fact that they couldn't go and get books because we still had assignments, but we had no materials with which to do the assignments and no clear idea of how that would be sort of accounted for or accommodated, really. Like, they're just like, oh yeah, we will accommodate it, and it's like, obviously they have to be a bit vague, but as a consequence, I think a lot of students felt sort of like they needed to go back to university, which is obviously not what the government really wanted them to do, and sort of, I think, led a lot of students to believe that maybe they would be able to go back in a staggered way at the beginning of January after the Christmas period, which wasn't really the case, because obviously we went into a lockdown, and obviously it's, I suppose, maybe a bit difficult for the government to predict exactly how things are going on, but you'd think with all the charts and so on, there'd be a bit more negotiation with the universities as what to do, not least because there's quite a lot of students who supposedly at the beginning of the, you know, semester or the year, really, like in September, the student year, they were being accused of spreading a lot of the virus, so you would have thought that they'd have thought about that a bit more, or maybe planned it.
Yeah, I think irresponsible is the right word, Rebecca, because, like, yes, the advice was don't go back to university, but most students had a room that they were paying for that they weren't living
exactly,
in.
Exactly, yeah.
And they didn't have the same access to the resources, and they probably, you know, were living in a state where their parents were off at work or whatever, and the house wasn't really conducive to just like a nice place to live, and it's just nicer to live with other students when you're in that mindset. So I think it was irresponsible not to consider that was going to happen and to make allowances for that.
Yeah, and I think, again, the government can sort of put the onus on students to be like, well, you know, lots of them shouldn't have gone back, without giving them necessarily the conditions that they sort of need, or, you know, practical solutions to issues so that they could stick to the restrictions more easily, or whatever. Yeah, so it's kind of, I think that's been an interesting thing. Do you guys think that these steps will be changed? They have been like a little bit careful with the way they've said it. They've like put, you know, 5 weeks after, no earlier than, sort of things with these new steps. But do you think it's going to work?
I'd put my neck on the line and say, to a certain degree, yeah, I think it will work. I think this is very, very cautious. The vaccine is only going to kind of ramp up the rollout of that. So yeah, I think changing it from dates to data, as a measure of, you know, how much you can relax things is a good thing, definitely. I mean, yeah, maybe I'm being naive, but I really really can see that this is the way out.
Yeah. I think that I've been really impressed so far with the vaccine rollout and the state of play with that. I hope that it's all going to be fine. I think there'll be a little bit of editing as we go, and sort of limiting and changing things, which is to be expected. But definitely the vaccine has completely changed what a lockdown means, because now the lockdown solution can be more permanent if the vaccine can get in there, which hopefully has happened. I heard somewhere that they were planning to have every adult vaccinated by the end of July.
Yeah.
Maybe first vaccines, is that right? Which, yeah, feels ambitious, but as far as I'm aware, we've got one of the faster vaccine programs, certainly that I've heard of, even internationally.
Mm. Yeah, you go ahead, Joe.
I mean, we've done like a third of adults now already, and it doesn't really feel like the vaccine program has been going that long. So to be a third of the way through adults already is a very good thing. And I think, you know, it seems sort of treasonous to say it, but I think there are a lot of young people who would be happy to do things, get back to normal and mix again without having the vaccine themselves, but in the knowledge that people who are older and their peers who have underlying medical conditions or whatever have had the vaccine. They know that.
Definitely.
If they're, as a result of their mixing, you know, no one's going to be severely ill. I think people would be people our age would be happy, you know, to you know, go about their lives, kind of thing. It's that thing that you're not going to be ill yourself, but you want to know that you're not going to make someone else ill.
Yeah, and I think also that obviously there's been a little bit of controversy over it, but the UK obviously has got a large supply of them. As, like, in the sense that obviously the, you know, France and some have been complaining a little bit, but, you know, it's all to do with bidding for the vaccines. The UK was one of the first countries really to get onto that properly, so that is really helpful. That's good. Yeah, okay, I think we've spoken enough about this story. I think we're going to move on to the next one with the Vice Chancellor. So over to you, Joe.
Yeah, so this is the story that last week in an online Q&A session, Vice Chancellor Shira West spoke to students about the concerns they have had over how the university has managed the latest set of restrictions and maybe some of the shortcomings in the university's support towards students. I mean, I think first it's important to say that this kind of dialogue that opened is the first of its kind, and whilst it's a bit late, certainly, I think that having a bit of a direct communication to university management, if you like, is a good step. I don't know whether, I'm going to ask, whether you think kind of, there was a bit of controversy last week that I was seeing on social media and stuff, that some of the questions were very sort of rehearsed and were planted or were, you know, thrown easily at the Vice Chancellor, that she could deliver a sort of glib response and say, oh, we're doing all the best, we're reviewing this, we're reviewing that. Whether you think there should be kind of more of this, where the questions should be a bit more direct and a bit more representative of a sort of anger rather than being, you know, polite and, you know, a bit sort of skirting the issue about that.
Yeah, I think it's a difficult one, isn't it, to like work out the balance of it, because on the one hand, you don't want to put off people from sort of engaging in it or sort of just shutting down with really vague answers, but at the same time, like, you do have to be quite direct, I think, and really get to the heart of the issue, and not sort of ask questions that have been, I don't know, watered down in a way to sort of placate the situation. You know, ultimately, if you have a responsibility to sort of I guess particularly like just stick to find out sort of the truth and really just be helpful to students, then you sort of have a responsibility, I guess, to be quite direct in your answers whilst obviously being respectful. But yeah, I don't know, it's a difficult one.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I don't think it's about, you know, anger, that's not gonna be productive, but no, there's nobody that doesn't understand the difficult position that the Vice Chancellor and the university as a whole is in. Like, everybody gets it, it's incredibly difficult for any large organisation to tackle this, but at the same time, students have paid a substantial amount of money for a service, and it's not, they're not getting the same level of service, and that's not the fault of the staff. And from where I'm sitting, most of the staff have been really great, but you know, there is a bit of the student union needs to be able to press and hold the Vice Chancellor accountable, and sort of press for student interest.
It's interesting you say that, Fred. One of the things that the Vice Chancellor was very clear about in one of her answers was that there are no plans to kind of even consider refunds for students.
Yeah.
And that's a debate that is kind of, I think, going to go on for much longer than the pandemic goes on, because it's been debated for years already. I think there's a general sense that uni fees were too expensive before this, are too expensive now. But one of the things the Vice Chancellor said was that it's kind of in balance with the salaries of the staff. So our fees pay the staff, and at the minute, you know, they're sort of, I don't know, only just about covering those salaries, never mind anything else. So it's a real kind of frustrating sense that the whole system is a little bit broken. And I, you know, sound like a broken record, but yeah, I think this kind of conversation will go on for a long time. One of the things that she did have to defend is actual support for self-isolating students. Now, it's not so much of an issue now because there are significantly fewer students having to isolate at the moment. Maybe whether that's because there are fewer students at uni, or, you know, the spread isn't quite as rapid as it was at previous levels. But do you think in general, I don't know whether anyone had direct experience or knew someone who was disappointed with support from the uni? Does anyone have a personal experience?
I don't know any. I didn't have anyone of a personal. I did hear about some stories, but I don't think I knew anyone like close, like no one in my flat or anything like that.
I mean, I worked like catering in some of the halls in during the period before Christmas and sort of packaging up the meals and taking it to people that were self-isolating. And just ended up having conversations with some of them as I was doing that. And, you know, a lot of them were very, very down about the circumstances, which is understandable, but, and it is difficult for the university to provide sufficient support, but, you know, they're like trapped in this sort of 6-foot by 6-foot room, and it's really not a very nice place to be. Mm-mm. Especially if you're a first year, if you're a second year, third year, and you're living out in Lenton, it's a little bit less of an issue because you've probably got housemates and all that sort of thing, but for first years that was really tough for them, I think.
Yeah, not pleasant at all. Was it kind of, I've not heard anything about this really, Fred, so it'd be good to have first-hand experience. Was it like quite a well-run operation, you think? In terms of getting food to halls and stuff?
I only worked in a few of the halls, so I can't speak to all of them. As much as it was possible, I would say it was pretty well-run, but then there were a lot of stories about people getting sort of delivered the wrong meals, or...
Yeah.
They were maybe cold by the time they got there, because there's an awful lot of students in halls, obviously, and to get, and there aren't that many kitchen staff mostly in halls. So it was a bit of a mad dash every time. Most of the time people seemed just grateful to have been given a meal, but I think there were lots of stories about, you know, vegetarians not being given that and having to change it and that sort of thing.
What interesting thing is that, you know, those students in halls who perhaps, if they did have to isolate, had quite a bad time of it compared to older students in private accommodation. You know, first years are the ones being offered compensation from halls which the uni owns, are being given rent holidays and stuff, which is something that, you know, older students, me particularly, from my own experience, I'm not having getting a rent reduction, and I'm not living in the house. So I know there are students that are living in the back in the halls now, and they're getting a holiday or whatever. You know, there is a sort of divide, and it's whether, I'm not saying they're not deserving of compensation at all, but that's what I was saying about the proportioning of compensation is a difficult question, because how do you say who's suffered the most, or how do you say who's missed out the most? Really, everyone's had a pretty rough time of it. But it's good to know that there was some kind of you know, proactiveness in that campaign that you're talking about, Fred.
What I found interesting about the article we're talking about, Joe, is that apparently the Manchester uni students have had kind of a vote of no confidence in their vice chancellor, which I didn't even realise was a thing. But
I didn't.
And I found that quite surprising, actually.
It's almost there are quite a few. Well, I remember a couple of months ago, there are lots of different petitions that ultimately are kind of after the same thing. It's almost as if maybe Manchester students have done it better in terms of actually a united front against kind of, you know, calling for a no confidence vote. I don't think that's kind of been waived here at all.
No.
And I'm not inciting anything. Don't take my lead on that. But it'll be interesting to see, you know, whether this sort of discussion that's happened last week, the Q&A, whether that does kind of, I don't know, suppress any other kind of student frustrations, whether it's taken further, whether, you know, that people feel that by opening this dialogue they've done enough, even though it's been so late. I doubt it. I think, you know, there'll be continued pressure on the uni, and rightly so, I think.
Yeah, I think you can understand why also a lot of students feel frustrated, but I can sort of sympathise with the university to a certain extent. I think it's difficult because we don't actually know what their finances are. Like, I'm not saying that the Vice-Chancellor isn't speaking the truth, but, like, I am also aware that a lot of their staff is, like, particularly the PhD students and things who do lecturing aren't actually paid as through... They're not a university staff, so they're, like, sort of paid very cheaply, sort of... by like the I think like per paper or so, it's like very little, so, and that has been, which was sort of partly why there were strikes, you know, was over university cuts in that sense.
Yeah.
So it's sort of difficult. On the one hand, you've got, you know, university staff saying we're not really being paid what we should be, and then the university saying, well, we're stretched as far as we can, we can't, there's no extra, you know, room for any other costs because we have to pay, basically all the money goes directly into the staff, which is confusing because if students are being paying the same amount or even more each year, then where's that going? I don't know, is it in accordance to inflation? I'm not sure, but it's just, I think it's like interesting. I can understand why the university can't really afford to give people their money back, but also it's really difficult for students because, like you were saying, Joe, like lots of people don't live in the accommodation which they're paying for, and it's just all a bit confusing, I think, the situation. So yeah, I think the students have like a right obviously to ask, and I know a lot of Manchester students were really upset because I think that was the same university that tore down the barricades.
Yeah.
I think,
yeah, that's right. I mean, they're a pretty sort of unique case in that it was you know, literally being surrounded in your accommodation and being told to stay there. It's a bit dramatic, so that perhaps might have, you know, much bigger cause for unrest, if you like. But like you say, Rebecca, I think if anything, what this whole time sort of exposed is that, you know, running a university like a business, this whole system, but it's so reliant on student fees. You know, how did they run it before students had to pay fees? Surely the money came from somewhere. I don't know. I think it might lead to a sort of national reckoning over how we run universities. I saw a thing in a paper today that they reckon too many people are going to university, which I don't agree with at all. I think that more people that go to university, you know, that's a good thing. But obviously there needs to be some kind of government inquiry into how we're running unis, how the funding works, because we don't know anything about it. Like, you know, this discussion is pretty ill-informed, if you like, because it's not a transparent process at all.
Yeah, it is a little bit relying on the university. Sorry, Freya, go ahead.
No, sorry. I think you're right, Joe. I think it shows how there is a lack of transparency on where those fees are spent. You know, the Vice Chancellor's told us that the fees are being spent on staffing and we can't give you a refund because it's got to go to the staff, and that's completely understandable, and nobody would want to, you know, reduce the staff's income at this time. But ultimately, the university must be making a profit from each annual year, that must happen, and they must be paying money to the upkeep of buildings that aren't in use at the moment, and all that sort of thing. There must be things that they're not spending money on in COVID times, and they must be making a profit. And you just wonder whether or not, you know, we don't have enough information about the financial affairs of the university, whether that's because we haven't sought it out, whether it's because it's not there. So I think that's what the Q&A really showed me, but at the same time you do kind of wonder how far the Q&A will get you if nothing's going to change, and you know how much action it will actually achieve.
Yeah. It makes the case really more than anything for more discussions and more detailed discussion. I think this was too vague and you know, needs to be repeated, I think. Sorry, Rebecca.
No, it's fine. Yeah, it's like you are sort of reliant, I think, obviously the way, because it's now like a business, it's, you are very reliant on the information that they give, which doesn't seem obviously very fair. And as a consequence, you know, I think it is important that students do ask these questions and so on, and really make a point of it, just so that, you know, universities don't feel too comfortable in sort of taking students' monies and setting, you know, the rules of what is okay and what isn't. You know, students do need to like sort of make some noise, because otherwise no one else is going to do it for them. So yeah, I think the Q&A is good, and hopefully we'll see, like, again, yeah, future, maybe more direct questions in the future with these. I think we're going to move on to the next story, which is obviously about the Olympics. Freya, do you want to talk about that?
So moving on from student things to more international news, there have been 180 organisations which have called on the government to boycott the Beijing Olympics, which are set to be in 2022, because of the treatment of the Uyghur Muslims in China at the moment. There's been the World Uyghur Congress has condemned the government for entering the Olympics, and the International Olympic Committee, who the Vice Chancellor, somebody called Dick Pound, has argued that the government should not withdraw from the Olympics because it will have no impact on the Chinese policy towards the Uyghur Muslims, and you know, the decision of who hosts the Olympics is not based on approval of any policy of that nation. We obviously have heard the sort of horrific stories coming out of the detention centres for Uyghur Muslims and, you know, mass surveillance, detention, sterilisation, the systemic rape of Uyghur women. And I just wondered what you guys thought, whether the UK should boycott the games, and if we did, whether you think this would have any impact.
I think certainly there is an argument maybe that geopolitics shouldn't be conducted through a global sporting event. It's a bit trivial when there are so many other kind of diplomatic things we could do, that might actually, as I think that is the vice president of the Olympic Committee said, might actually have an effect on the policy of the Chinese government towards Uyghurs. But this would set such a, it would, you know, such a, send such a signal, I think, in complete condemnation of what's going on, which is just dreadful. And what really about this story in its, you know, entirety is that, it just does not seem to get the acknowledgement on an international level that it deserves. You know, what's going on is a Holocaust. It's just awful that this is being allowed to happen. I can't understand why. I know, again, we're in the midst of a pandemic, why there isn't a bit more of a, you know, absolute international uproar about this. To my mind, if I ran the country, yeah, completely call off the Olympics, do what, you know. I don't know what you think, Rebecca.
Yeah, I agree. I think that on the one hand, I don't really believe the idea that it wouldn't do anything, but I also don't know, like, I feel like, well, for one thing, I don't think they should be hosting it at all. Like, I think that there should have been an agreement that, you know, China shouldn't have been allowed to host it. But now we're in this situation. I don't know what legally the UK can do, in the sense of obviously, like, pulling out is one thing, but I don't know whether you have to have some kind of justification for it. And because it's sports, I don't know whether it should fit. There should be, you know, a perfectly valid reason, but I don't know, like, exactly the details of it, you know, legally. I don't know where it stands, so there's a practicality element to it. But yeah, I agree. I think that something more than just stepping out of the Olympics needs to be done. And obviously people always talk about the fact that sports and politics are sort of inextricable, but obviously I think there needs to be stuff done, you know, in the wider political sense. It's one thing to, like, boycott it in a symbolic way, but there also needs to be, like, some practical something being done. And I agree, I don't know really why. I guess the way it's been hushed down is because of maybe China's power in, like, the economy, in the world economy or something. I'm not really sure.
Yeah, I think, yeah. Western countries are a bit too reliant on China. That's been proven in the coronavirus pandemic, so maybe that's what it's about. Freya, sorry, I interrupted you.
No. I think you're absolutely right in saying that China should never have been given the Olympics in the first place. Dick Pound, who was the vice president of the IOC, said that the hosting decisions are not made on the basis of approval of government policy. And I would argue that that's fine, but, you know, this isn't some sort of political decision. This is a human rights violation, yeah. Which I would argue is, you know, very solid grounds not to be hosting an international sports competition.
It's a difficult one for athletes, though. You know, it's so much for a government to say, we don't support this games going ahead. We're not going to send any diplomats there. You know, we're not going to. But can you really stop an athlete from competing, kind of thing? Because essentially, that's you know, their life's work, isn't it? But yeah, I mean, it's a whole logistical nightmare kind of thing. What a strong name, by the way, Dick Pound. Any eventuality you can mention that name, I'd take it. But I think it's a really difficult decision for an athlete to have to make.
Yeah, it depends on how much flexibility they have in their own sort of schedule. And I don't know how, I'm not an athlete, so I have no idea how much. Like, I don't know whether, like, quite a lot of their money, I would assume a lot of their money and sponsorship and so on is very dependent on the actual games themselves. So I guess maybe that for some people, maybe they can't afford not to go. But then at the same time, obviously, I think you have to really weigh up your personal sort of situation and also, like, obviously a much wider and very important moral one as well. So I guess the government can't, you know, stop people from going, but I guess there's a other thing of like not endorsing it in the first place. But I don't know that the UK would do anything really. I understand why people want them to boycott, but I don't know whether it's just likely at all. Not least because also, again, the issue with these countries is, you know, if China was a small country and wasn't very powerful and fairly inconsequential in the sense of like the UK pulling out, then A, the UK could easily do it and they probably would, but also B, maybe this situation wouldn't be happening in the first place because they wouldn't have the power to do so. I don't know.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, because there is a sense of, you know, even if the UK did pull out of the game, it wouldn't affect really what China's doing. I don't think that boycotting the games would have any impact on Chinese policy, but there has to be sort of a moment where, as a nation, we go, this is not... And anyway, I think you're right about how the difficult position that it puts athletes in, because ultimately they're not, you know, political actors. They're just there. They just want to play sport and do their thing, and they shouldn't be sort of held... They shouldn't sort of be politicised while they're doing that. But I definitely think that we should boycott diplomatically at the very least.
Mm.
And there is a sense of, because China's so powerful, you know, what can we do to actually stop this happening? You know, we can't just declare war, we can't just sort of cut all economic ties, because as a country we're kind of indebted to them economically. So there is a sense of, this is kind of one of the only things that we can do to signify any kind of dissent. So I think we should be taking it more seriously than we are. I think you're right about the lack of sort of international attention on this.
Yeah, that's interesting actually, Fred, that we're looking at it. You know, we can't do much economically that wouldn't, you know, hurt our own economy, but we can boycott the Olympic Games as a symbolic move. Yeah, I think that's an interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that is an interesting way. I think that probably would be helpful. I also don't know that, like, China would necessarily know what to, like, in the sense that I don't think there would be much kickback, because obviously, well, you can't boycott our Olympics if we're not having one. So, like, you know, I don't see there necessarily being, like, a reciprocation that there. But I guess maybe also it ultimately falls into UN's hands, but they don't seem to be doing a lot about it. And I think a lot of it's also to do with the fact that China's covering up a lot of stuff, so it's sort of difficult for them to have grounds with which to do something with. But it definitely does feel, it's not like, in as much as, you know, I think it would be good for the UK to do something in this case, like, I don't know how much power the UK really has. Ultimately, I think the UN has to do something.
But obviously China's got veto power on the Security Council, so
yeah.
At being part of the UN gives China a kind of quite a large say over whether it's committing a human rights violation, when it probably shouldn't be having an opinion on that. Yeah,
it's like, it's a really difficult situation. I mean, I don't think that anything, they're going to boycott the Olympics. What do you guys think?
I'd be surprised if we did. I think at the most we might extend a diplomatic boycott, but I certainly think we'll be sending athletes.
Yeah, I think I agree. The Foreign Office seem to be in quite kind of in tune with it, and obviously condemning it in the strongest terms, and I think you're right, Fred, they might diplomatically boycott it, but yeah, it's my point, you know, athletes will still go, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, it's,
I mean, there is a historical, sorry.
No, go ahead.
There is a historical, you know, precedent for the Olympic Games being used, you know, in Nazi Germany in 1936 to sort of legitimise Hitler's power. And, you know, the US boycotted the 1918 Games in the Soviet Union, and then the Soviet Union did the same to them in 1984. So there is a precedent for it. But I don't know how much of an impact it would have even if we did.
Equally, athletes going and maybe doing some kind of symbolic act whilst they're actually at the game. But there's also a precedent of, you know, big sporting events like that being used by sports people as activists for certain social movements. So it might, if we did end up sending athletes, it would do more to shed light on, in the coverage of an Olympic Games, it would do more to shed light on, you know, what's going on in terms of the human rights violations. It might sort of work that way around, kind of counterintuitively.
Yeah, there is that, exactly, like there is a sort of precedent for that. So you think maybe it would be, they'd be able to still do some kind of like something in principle there. I think, you know, like no one's under the illusion of like the fact that I don't think the UK approves of, like, the government doesn't approve obviously of what's happening, but I guess there's just, you know, whilst boycotting would be good symbolically, I guess no one's necessarily I think there needs to be more coverage of it, but I don't think people are confused of how other countries feel about China doing it. I guess there's just like a practical sense of like what do you do next, like how do you do something about it. And I guess one thing that's maybe different to like say Soviet Union or so on is that because China sort of plays is a world player in the sense of like, especially economically speaking, I guess a lot of countries, unlike the Soviet Union, which is considered like, you know, very much an enemy, there's no negotiations going on, you know, at that point in history, China's like considered to be an economic partner for a lot of countries, so it's like they're very much at the table rather than like somebody who you could easily boycott in that sense. But I think, you know, something's got to be done, whether it's a boycott or something more politically, so hopefully this won't be like the last that we hear of sort of, I guess, actions being taken against China, you know, taking a stand, so to speak. Yeah, okay, I think maybe, yeah, we've come to the end of the Pulse today. So if you're not following us on Twitter, our @ is @ URM Pulse. Hopefully we'll also be back in the studio sometime soon, but obviously depending on the restrictions and what it means for universities, which we're still not 100% clear on. But if not, we will be uploading onto the Twitter and Audioboom. So yeah. Okay, thanks for listening.